Only a Game is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org. Additional support comes from the Jackson Laboratory, researching the root causes of cancer and other genetic diseases, designated a cancer center by the National Cancer Institute, JAX.org.
From WBUR in Boston, I'm Bill Littlefield, and this is NPR's Only a Game. Would love to have you sign a letter of intent, LOL, ahead on Only a Game. How Twitter and Facebook are changing the recruitment of college football players. Also meet the American pro sports team without a phone number, a website, or a front office, and a conversation with a poker champion who came to the tables of Las Vegas via a Thai refugee camp. Also ahead, UNC Charlotte gambles on football.
Quite honestly, I've had a few athletic directors that are friends of mine across the country said, what are you doing? What are you thinking? Do you know how good you've had it? But if you would ask them if they would really go back, none of them would say, let's do away with it.
Stay tuned.
Major funding for Only a Game comes from Oliver Wyman, an international strategy consulting firm. With 3,000 professionals worldwide, Oliver Wyman serves global 1,000 companies. OliverWyman.com.
This is Only a Game. I'm Bill Littlefield. From what I understand, the kids these days are into something called social media. And kids includes talented high school athletes. Now many of the college coaches recruiting those athletes have been forced to get hip to Facebook and Twitter in a hurry. Pete Thamel explores that phenomenon in his article, Coaches' New Friends, which appeared this week in the New York Times. Pete, welcome back to Only a Game.
Bill, thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
West Virginia football coach Dana Holgorsen told you that Facebook is, quote, probably the only way to communicate with recruits. It's no secret that the popularity of Facebook and Twitter has exploded over the past several years, but give us some perspective on social media's impact on college recruiting.
Well, I think between Twitter and Facebook, they're the main conduits that coaches reach out to kids, and this is a societal evolution, Bill, as much as it is a, you know, college sports specific evolution. Email is old school. I mean, it might as well be the carrier pigeon or smoke signals. And kids use Facebook basically to send quick burst messages to each other through the inboxing function. And it's to the point, I realized I was going to do this story when I was talking to a coach on the phone about something else, and I asked him about landing a recruit, and he told me, yeah, I Facebooked him every night. And Facebook has become a verb in the in the college game, and inboxing is another verb, because that's Facebook's email function. And it's even to the point where I talked to a prep school coach after this story ran on Monday, and he told me, he said, oh, God, my guys say Facebook is so over. They do everything on Twitter now. So it's hard to keep up.
In 2007, the NCAA created a pretty clear rule about text messaging. Coaches are not allowed to send text messages to high school athletes. And the NCAA has some rules, I guess, about Facebook and Twitter, but not very many. Why the contradiction?
Well, what happened in 07, and NCAA is a very reactive organization, and typically a slow reactive organization at that, and they banned text messaging because, as you probably know from your own cell phone, Bill, there used to be plans where you could only send 50 or 100 texts a month. So when you had Johnny Five-Star Tailback in Texas, he was getting, you know, he's getting a couple hundred texts from all over the country. Now, from coaches, from these recruiting services, million-dollar businesses who call up kids and ask them, you know, what schools they're considering. So these kids were getting bombed, and then their parents were getting bombed with the bill.
Right, because you had to pay for receiving these things as well as sending them, obviously.
Exactly. So because of that, and because it was put a financial strain on the families, and it was intrusive, the NCAA just outright banned it. Well, since 2007, a lot has changed, and now pretty much Facebook messages and Twitter messages come to your phone in the exact same fashion the texts used to come. So the NCAA is now considering lifting its text message ban because now everybody has unlimited texts.
Recruiting is an essential part of any major college basketball or football program, but many of the coaches you spoke to were reluctant to start using social media, and some still don't use it at all. Tell us about some of the holdouts.
Yeah, well, I mean, recruiting is the single most important part of any program. You need players. I mean, the old saying, Bill, it's not the X's and the O's, it's the Jimmys and the Joes. And in order to get Jimmy and Joe on your campus, it's an intricate courtship. Some of the coaches, and we all have relatives, friends like this. There are some coaches who just say, you know, I've been doing this since, you know, 1970, whatever, and I did it with handwritten notes, and I did it with that, and it's almost like the father who can't figure out how to use the DVD player, and he just has his kids do it for him every time. Well, I think there's some old school coaches who say, I'm not going to get on Facebook. I'm going to delegate that to my assistant coaches, and they're sort of proud to kick that aside to their assistants.
But it does mean that you'd have to have somebody on your staff who could handle this stuff, right? Or the kids would just write you off as hopeless.
Yes. And I'd imagine that, you know, say there's Coach Smith at State. I'd imagine that Coach Smith has a Facebook account, except he doesn't use it. And, you know, his 24-year-old recently graduated graduate assistant is supplying the communication messages to appease the kids. And I think the kids, it's sort of the constant attention and the constant buzzing of the phone. It's almost like an addiction, a craving. Oh, who's hitting me up today? Mm. I need it now.
Pete, this week the NCAA held a two-day summit to look at simplifying its rule book and toughening up its academic standards. Do you expect substantial changes in terms of how athletes can be recruited?
I don't expect substantial changes. I think there'll be some window dressing stuff. I do think they will eventually come back and allow text messaging to be used because they're finding that these communication mediums are the same. But I don't think, I mean, there's a lot of problems in college sports, and most of those problems are based in recruiting and illegal recruiting, as we saw last year with the Newton case that really overwhelmed and overshadowed most of the college football season.
It's almost as if they did start to address the new media, some other new media would explode so fast that they'd be behind again.
I've been doing this now probably for about 15 years covering college sports, and it was talk radio and it was message boards. There's always some sort of new communication form that takes on a life of its own in, you know, in both recruiting and in college sports. And Twitter and Facebook are the things of the moment, but as we know in this age, moments don't last very long.
Keeping that in mind, Pete, looking into the future, is there any hope for the ancient recruiting tools like email and voicemail making a return?
Well, the great hope is Joe Paterno. he said the other day that in his day, Twitter was when a girl walked by in a short skirt with nice legs and everyone was all a Twitter. So that's the that's for the holdouts. Go with Joe Pa.
Pete Thamel covers college sports for the New York Times. You can link to his article, Coach's New Friends, at our website, onlyagame.org. And if you're a coach or you'd like to recruit me to play for your football or basketball program, you're nuts. But hit me up on Twitter or Facebook anyway at onlyagameradio. Pete, thanks very much for speaking with me.
Bill, thanks for having me on.
The athletic history at the University of North Carolina at Charlotte begins and ends with former NBA star Cedric Cornbread Maxwell, who brought the 49ers to the Final Four in 1977. But campus leaders at UNC Charlotte are looking forward to the return to athletic glory, this time in football. The entire program right now consists of a head coach, a couple of assistants, and a slick video.
It's a team led by a few and followed by many. It's college football. And for the Charlotte 49ers, it's a rush.
UNC Charlotte is one of only a handful of schools to recently start a football program from scratch. Reporter Dave DeWitt visited the Charlotte campus to see how the plans are coming along.
UNC Charlotte Athletic Director Judy Rose purposely avoids driving past the enormous dirt mounds on the edge of campus that will soon become the school's football stadium. She says the relatively slow progress makes her anxious to see more and reminds her of all that still needs to be done.
Quite honestly, I've had a few athletic directors that are friends of mine across the country said, what are you doing? What are you thinking? Do you know how good you've had it? But if you would ask them if they would really go back, if they were serious about it and say, can I imagine my university where I am right now and my athletic program, our athletic program, without the sport of football? None of them would say let's do away with it.
Rose says she spends about 90% of her time working on football, a sport the school doesn't have yet. It's hoped that football will transform this former commuter school into a so-called big-time university. UNC Charlotte is already there in some ways. It will have more students than its more well-known cousin, UNC Chapel Hill, in a few years. But while Chapel Hill's been around for more than 200 years, Charlotte didn't offer its first four-year degree until the 1960s. The school is so new, it didn't even get a song designated as an official alma mater until 1992. School leaders now dream of different traditions. Crisp fall afternoons, alumni tailgating, maybe tearing down the odd goalpost or two after a big win over a hated rival. And maybe most important, according to Chancellor Philip Dubois, getting on TV.
You know, it's not the physics department's fault that they're not on ESPN, but the reality is that they just don't get that kind of attention. We could be talking about our mission statement, and we wouldn't get one television camera.
Dubois says he was reluctant to pursue football at first, but he got more into the spirit back in April when the school broke ground on the stadium.
Are you ready for some football?
The answer, if you are history professor David Goldfield, is a resounding no.
I hate to be a curmudgeon about this, but there are lots of positives with the football program on the campus of UNC Charlotte, but my concern is the economic cost of such a program.
Goldfield isn't your average curmudgeon. He was UNC Charlotte's athletics faculty representative to the NCAA for 17 years, and he has season basketball tickets. But he says spending $45 million on a stadium and another $6 million or so a year on the football program is too much, especially when the city of Charlotte is the largest metropolitan area in the country without a medical school, a niche the campus could fill. And Goldfield is especially bothered by how UNC Charlotte is paying for football, with a $350 increase in annual student fees.
For our students, many of them work, many of them come from families where they're the first generation going to college and are really struggling to make ends meet, particularly in this economy. Basically, we're trying to build a football program on the backs of our students.
Maybe now would be the time to cut to a campus protest or hear from a disgruntled student, outraged that his or her hard-earned money is going to pay for something like football. But student support for the fee increase is nearly universal. Amanda Markham is the student body vice president.
It's something that I've been advocating for since I first got here at UNC Charlotte, and I really saw it take shape in student government. That's kind of where it started. Then transferred onto the students, and there's really a grassroots movement.
In 2008, an online survey sponsored by the student government showed overwhelming student support for raising fees to build the stadium and the football program. Markham says starting football allows her generation a rare opportunity.
We're a relatively young institution, so this gives us an opportunity that a lot of other schools don't have to really be able to choose who we are and our own traditions and what we want to be.
Markham says she'll be on campus early on that first game day, August 31st, 2013. She looks forward to tailgating, sharing in the school spirit, and hopefully winning. And maybe there will even be a marching band. UNC Charlotte doesn't have one of those yet. For Only a Game, I'm Dave DeWitt.
It's 19 minutes past the hour. On Monday night, a fan at the game between the Jacksonville Sharks and the Georgia Force demonstrated one of the peculiar charms of the Arena Football League. As Force receiver C.J. Johnson fielded a kick during the American Conference Finals, said fan grabbed Johnson's helmet, pulled on his face mask, and basically tackled him. Even before Johnson had stopped wondering how somebody on the defense had slipped behind him and into the stands, several of the Sharks ran down the field to high-five the fan for his enthusiastic support, hence pretty much assuring that in some arena football game in the not-so-distant future, it'll happen again.
I'm Bill Littlefield. Coming up on Only a Game, on the soccer front, Magic Jack is not phoning it in. But first, before the PGA Championship began on Thursday, people wondered if this would be the major in which Tiger Woods regained his form. They didn't have to wait long for the answer to that question, but there's still lots to be determined at the Atlanta Athletic Club. I'm joined now by Golf.com Deputy Director David Dusek, who's at the tournament. David, welcome back to Only a Game.
It's good to speak with you again, Bill. Thanks.
Tiger Woods shot 77 on Thursday, and so the question as day two began was not whether he could win the PGA Championship, but whether he would make the cut, and as it turned out, he couldn't. He was 10 over par after two rounds. Are his injuries still bothering him, or is he rusty, or have time and events just done him in?
I think it's a combination of a lot of things, Bill, but clearly Tiger Woods is far from being the golfer that basically dominated the 2000s, and he says, and he has said numerous times now, that he is 100% healthy, and that's actually something he feels very good about, the fact that he's able to play consecutive events. He played last week's PGA Tour event in Akron, Ohio, although he finished in the middle of the pack. He feels confident that he's actually feeling good after two tournaments and not feeling any pain, and that's the first time that that's happened in quite a bit, although certainly the way he played on both Thursday and Friday gave him a lot of pain. Tiger was exceptionally frustrated. He was missing the fairway off the tee, both left and right, which is a very bad thing for a professional player. He didn't putt especially well, and his irons were basically distance control is the name of the game when it comes to irons, and his was terrible. So there really isn't any aspect of Tiger's game that's going well for him right now.
Rory McIlroy has been compared to the young Tiger Woods. He shot 70 on Thursday after injuring his wrist early in the round. Was it a triumph for him even to play yesterday?
Rory McIlroy has a lot of talent, and what we learned on Thursday and Friday is that he has a lot of heart. Rory wants to win this tournament very, very badly. He wants to win every tournament that he plays very badly. And on the third hole, when his 7-iron hit a root, it actually bent, and he had to play without a 7-iron on Thursday, and he hurt that tendon. He showed a lot of guts and a lot of determination in just finishing the round, and we don't believe that it really bothered him all that much on Friday. He's shown a lot of heart and determination. He's got tremendous talent, but boy, I question why he decided to keep going, because it looked like he was in tremendous amount of pain. You would hate to see a guy who's 22 years old with that much of a future ahead of him compromise that, either for the short term or the long term.
By playing in pain and playing well enough to make the cut, do you suppose Mr. McIlroy increased the size of his following on the course and among TV viewers?
He already has a humongous following. He's a sensation in Europe. He can't walk the streets without getting mobbed, and slowly but surely he's becoming a superstar here in the United States. I think that this is something that will add to the legend, but it will only add to the legend and the mystique of Rory McIlroy if he's able to get himself a little bit more into the mix and more towards the top of the leaderboard. Right now, I think we all have tremendous respect for the fact that he's there and what he's accomplished so far, but Rory, to this point at least, has not been one of the major players in terms of people who we think may end up winning this tournament.
Steve Stricker tied a PGA Championship record by carding a 63 on Thursday. He said after the round that he wasn't aware that he had a shot at setting a new record. Would have been 62. Do you believe him?
I don't. I think that any time, according to his caddy was very aware that Steve Stricker had a birdie putt on his last hole that would have set a major championship record and given him a 62. He was aware of it but chose not to tell Steve. I can't believe with the number of leaderboards around and the simple math of not having made a bogey and realizing that you've made 7 birdies to that point, that Steve wasn't aware. He's a veteran player. He has yet to win a major championship. He's known as one of the best putters on tour, and he didn't miss a thing on Thursday. So I have to believe that he was very well aware of what he needed to do to set golf history.
Stricker might have felt as if he'd figured the course out on day one, but that did not turn out to be the case yesterday, did it?
No, golf is a very fickle thing, and one of the most difficult things that any professional golfer has to face is coming back the day after shooting an exceptionally good round. Stricker, with that 63, probably knew in the back of his head that there was going to be some bogeys that he was going to make at some point or another on Friday, and he made them early, surprisingly with a 3-putt on one of his first holes that sort of started a trend. He battled back a little bit, but he still shot 4 over par for the round, a very un-Stricker-like performance. But it's exceptionally difficult, especially in a major championship, to put together two special rounds, and his round certainly on Thursday was very special.
Up at the top of the leaderboard now, we find Jason Duffner, Keegan Bradley, and D.A. Points. Help me out here. Tell me something about these would-be winners.
You didn't have them in your office pool?
I didn't even have them on the list.
You have to be a pretty big golf fan to be follower of Jason Duffner, Keegan Bradley, and D.A. Points. Although I will say that Keegan Bradley, although being a PGA Tour rookie, did win the Byron Nelson Championship in May at a big tournament in Dallas, Texas, and has had an exceptional summer. Jason Duffner and D.A. Points are what you would refer to as journeymen on the PGA Tour. They're guys who a lot of times when the big boys like Tiger Woods and Phil Mickelson and Ernie Els aren't winning championships, these are a lot of the guys who collect a pretty nice living, thank you very much, from getting a top 10 performance here and there, a top 15, and they're in a very nice high tax bracket without having won a major championship. This is a very different situation for themselves, for John Sendon, who is also tied for third after Thursday and Friday's rounds. You really have to go down to somebody like Jim Furyk and potentially Stricker and Adam Scott, who won last week, and lurking around there is Lee Westwood also, to really find players that, the casual fan may have heard about, but this shows the depth and the quality of the PGA Tour and of golf right now.
Well, consider those first dozen or so names on the top of the leaderboard halfway through this tournament, and tell me who's most likely to play well enough today and tomorrow to win the thing.
Well, I think that I'll be very surprised if Jason Duffner, Bradley, D.A. Points, John Sennon, again, Anders Hansen, people who, even a pretty good golf fan may have a little bit of trouble learning about or really knowing, if they're going to be able to hold together. The pressure of a weekend at a major championship is something that they haven't experienced, and it's pretty significant. Jim Furyk won the U.S. Open in 2003, and I think that he'll probably stick around. He's putting beautifully. I also think that Steve Stricker is definitely going to keep himself in the mix, but the name that I sort of look at the top of the leaderboard is Lee Westwood, who was 2 under par on his round on Friday, 1 under par for the tournament. I think that he is the guy, although he hasn't won a major, he's number 2 in the world. I see Lee Westwood as being the man to beat.
David Dusek, Golf.com deputy editor, is tweeting from the PGA Championship, and you can follow him at golf.com_Dusek. David, thank you very much for speaking with me. The Women's Professional Soccer League will conclude the regular season with 3 games tomorrow. In one of them, the Philadelphia Independents will visit Magic Jack, which used to be the Freedom, located in Washington, D.C. Now, and perhaps very temporarily, Magic Jack, which is named for the phone company run by their owner, Dan Borislow, plays on the campus of Florida Atlantic University in Boca Raton. The field on that campus has been a problem for the league. The capacity of the facility is too small, even by WPS standards, and that's only one of the reasons for the season-long conflict between the league and Mr. Borislow, who's in the running for most eccentric owner of a pro sports franchise ever. He fired his coach, Mike Lyons, 3 games into the season, though the team was 3-0. Since then, several players have taken turns coaching Magic Jack on a rotating volunteer basis. For a while, Mr. Borislow did it himself until someone in the league office pointed out that he didn't have the requisite coach's license. All this seemed to have the makings of an intriguing story, so on the eve of last weekend's game between Magic Jack and the Breakers in Boston, I tried calling the Florida team to set up an interview.
You have reached a number that has been disconnected or is no longer in service. Please check the number and try your call again.
I subsequently learned that my failure to contact anyone at Magic Jack put me at the end of a long line.
There is no website, there's no phone number, there's no front office, there's no ticket office, there's no way to get a hold of the team.
Michelle Kaufman of the Miami Herald has been covering Dan Borislow's team, a sometimes frustrating exercise.
I get calls from people such as the vice president of the Miami Dolphins, who was trying to get a hold of Magic Jack because the Dolphins wanted to honor the players who were in the World Cup at a Dolphin game, and they couldn't even get through.
The WPS, the finances of which might charitably be described as fragile, needs all the publicity it can get. It's no surprise that the league is dismayed with an owner who not only doesn't employ a general manager or a public relations person, but who is alleged to have forbidden his players to use social media, which the rest of the WPS teams embrace. Dan Borislow's team is the only one to have points deducted for the owner's transgressions against league rules and standards. But Magic Jack will be going to the playoffs anyway.
By beating the Breakers 2-0 on Saturday night, Magic Jack clinched third place. Abby Wambach headed in both goals. Megan Rapinoe set Wambach up on one of them. Hope Solo did not play due to injury. Do these names ring a bell? All three represented the U.S. at this summer's World Cup in Germany, as did four other Magic Jack players. After Saturday's game, Wambach, currently coaching as well as scoring for Borisov's team, was asked to comment on the disputes between the owner and the league.
There's always a time and place when things need to be dealt with, but the truth is, we've let Dan deal with the stuff off the field. None of the players have a say, have anything to do with the stuff that is between Dan and the league. That's his business. And for us, it may affect us down the road, but we're not focusing on that.
Not focusing on the circumstances Dan Borisov has created can't have been easy. Magic Jack arrived at the Breakers field without a trainer. Several of the players asked the Breakers staff if they'd tape their ankles before the game. Sure, they were told. Do you have tape? No, said the Magic Jack players. Could you bring some with you? Two former Magic Jack players now with the Breakers are living with Claire Massington and her family. I asked Ms. Massington to confirm the rumor that one of Mr. Borisov's former employees had compared leaving his team to escaping from North Korea.
I don't want to be too impolitic, but she said she was quite relieved to be with the Breakers, and she mentioned something about having enjoying such a structured practice when she got here.
Dan Borisov's position has been that he's losing a lot of money running the team, and he's not willing to fund any personnel beyond the players or spend frivolously on such items as athletic tape. The league's position, according to a statement sent to Only a Game on Thursday, is that Mr. Borisov, quote, has disrupted the league's business by creating conflicts with national partners, presenting an unprofessional product, negatively influencing fans, and adversely affecting players due to his mistreatment of his own team and staff. That last contention is bolstered by a grievance filed in July by some of the players who accused Borisov of bullying them as well as failing to live up to league standards of professionalism. Last week, Dan Borisov filed a lawsuit to prevent the league from taking the team away from him before this season ends, which the league says it never intended to do, though Michelle Kaufman thinks things might be different once the playoffs end.
I don't imagine that this team is going to last after this season. I just can't imagine that the league is going to allow a team to be run this way. I understand he's saying, hey, it's my team, it's my money. They should be happy that I'm promoting women's soccer with money out of my pocket. But it's really very, very unprofessional. You go to the league website, and it lists the six teams, and you can click on a link to all the five other teams, and when you get to Magic Jack, you don't get anything.
The current status of Dan Borisov's lawsuit against the league is foggy, and Mr. Borisov has not responded to inquiries via his personal email address, which Michelle Kaufman thinks might still work. The league has limited its response to Only a Game's inquiry to the aforementioned three-paragraph statement, which concludes with the contention that, quote, it will not and cannot tolerate owners whose actions jeopardize the future of WPS. Beyond that, fans of Magic Jack and the WPS can only wait to see what will happen, although Michelle Kaufman can't help fantasizing about the scene that would transpire if Abby Wambach and her teammates keep scoring often enough to win the league's championship.
So I can't even imagine that trophy ceremony with the commissioner of the league and Dan Borisov standing on the same podium. That would be a sight to see.
The WPS postseason begins on either August 17th or 18th, depending on whether the Breakers or Sky Blue FC wins tomorrow. One of those teams will gain the opportunity to play Magic Jack, whose players may or may not be able to count on getting a ride to the game. You're listening to Only a Game. Jeffrey Pierce, who hears Only a Game on KUHF in Houston, Texas, is thinking ahead. He emailed this week to ask what would happen if the Yankees and the Red Sox were to finish the regular season with identical records. Assuming those teams have a better record than the winners in the other two divisions, he wondered which team would be the division winner and which would enter the playoffs via the wild card.
Mr. Pierce, there would be a one-game playoff. It would probably be very entertaining, and thanks for the question, because in these complicated and challenging times, I'm grateful for one that I can answer. Having heard my conversation with Don Van Natta, the author of a new biography of Babe Diedrichson Zaharias, Greg Seifert of Crete, Illinois, started reading the book, and he emailed to convey his reaction. Tremendous athlete, he wrote, but an even more enormous ego. What a nightmare of a teammate. Mike Thorpe, who hears the program on Vermont Public Radio, is apparently a selective, if enthusiastic, listener. Both my partner and I tune in every Saturday morning, he wrote, except when March rolls around. There are so many sports other than basketball to discuss, and we can't stand the focus on one of the few sports that is less interesting than watching paint dry. It's fair to conclude that Mr. Thorpe is not especially troubled by the NBA lockout. And finally, a listener who only identified himself or herself as Coladas emailed to express delight at last week's story about the dainty championships held in Louisville, Kentucky. The message read, in part, "This game reminds me of Laurel and Hardy's classic film March of the Wooden Soldiers." I wondered about that reference until I found a clip of Stan Laurel showing Oliver Hardy how to play a game that does, in fact, look suspiciously like dainty.
What is this peewee business you've been spending all of my money on?
Would you like to see it?
Well, certainly I'd like to see it. After all the money it's cost me, I think I'm entitled to know what it's all about.
All right, look. What do you think of that?
Piffle. That's the silliest thing I have ever seen.
Whether or not you can make one stick jump into the air by hitting it with another stick and then knock that first stick into the distance with a second stick, you can tell us what you think of anything you've heard on Only a Game by visiting our website, onlyagame.org. You can leave a message on the listener line by calling 617-353-1860. You can also find us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at Only a Game Radio. It's 22 and a half minutes before the hour.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where the program is produced, Harvard University, whose Harvard Extension School has online and on-campus courses for students around the world, extension.harvard.edu, and Oliver Wyman, an international strategy consulting firm. With 3,000 professionals worldwide, Oliver Wyman serves global 1,000 companies. OliverWyman.com. This is NPR.
This week, the San Francisco Giants announced that on September 4th, the team will stage Star Wars Day at AT&T Park. There will be a costume contest for fans inclined to come as Luke Skywalker, Princess Leia, R2-D2, or Jar Jar Binks, and in what the Giants are calling the greatest promotional giveaway in the history of professional sports, fans will receive a three-sided carbonite statue featuring not only Han Solo, but Giants pitcher Brian Wilson in his trademark post-save celebration pose. After the game, everyone who doesn't regard baseball as sufficient entertainment for one night can attend a screening of The Empire Strikes Back. I'm Bill Littlefield. Coming up on Only a Game, Jerry Yang's unlikely journey from a refugee camp in Thailand to the final table at the World Series of Poker in Las Vegas. But first, I'm joined by Charlie Pierce for our look at the week's news. Hello, Charlie.
Hey, Bill.
Major League Baseball has announced the postseason schedule for 2011, and the big news is that at the very latest, the season will end on October 27th, so... what a sad thing. Goodbye to November baseball.
Well, it's nice to know that some things can embarrass Major League Baseball, and I think November baseball did it. Now, they can all go trick-or-treating with their children. This is sweet.
It is sweet.
This is family-friendly postseason scheduling. No, this is a good thing. Getting rid of the off days was a great idea. You cannot play baseball well in November as long as, you know, any team in the upper latitudes is going to compete. So, speaking parochially, it's good for the Red Sox and their fans. And speaking generally for baseball fans, you get higher quality play.
On Thursday, Tigers ace Justin Verlander became the first major leaguer to reach 17 wins this season. He's also one of just seven pitchers since 1969 with five 17-win seasons before reaching the age of 29. And it was his 100th career win, which Verlander says is no big deal at all. Why is that?
He said it was never a goal of his, and he thinks, I think his goal may well be 300 wins, and he may actually get there.
Rangers pitcher C.J. Wilson will be a free agent this winter. I wonder what happens if he gets signed by Oakland.
He's not going to go there because, as he put it, I hate pitching there. The mound sucks. The fans suck. There's no fans there. Now, this opens up the existential question.
Yes.
If there are no fans there, how can they suck?
Right. It's the old tree in the
That's right.
center field or something.
Is he saying they're bad at their jobs or something? Or they don't mow their lawns well?
They're bad
How would he
people.
Know they suck if they're not there?
This week, ESPN.com ran an article in which four anonymous relief pitchers accused a man in a white shirt of stealing signs from the Toronto Blue Jays outfield seats during a game in 2010. And so I assume Blue Jays general manager Alex Anthopoulos immediately launched an investigation.
Yes, and he said it was stupid and has a lot of holes in it. The story, not the white shirt in particular. These are one of these great baseball stories that I hope they never find the answer to. You know, I hope the next time that one of these teams comes in and plays the Blue Jays, everybody in the outfield wears a white shirt.
Well, what I liked about this was there was a picture of the center field bleachers on the web the other day with a guy holding up a huge sign that said, fastball.
Between this and Tony La Russa accusing the Brewers of sending sending subliminal messages through the lights on the scoreboard, baseball's getting wonderfully silly again.
We still have a few weeks before the college football season officially begins, but do you have a favorite entry among the Athlon Sports College Football's 2011 all-name team?
Well, there are a lot of ones. Actually, there's one locally at Boston College, a wide receiver named Spiffy Evans, which is good, and Philander Moore, that's not, Dreamius Smith at Kansas. Sir Gregory Thornton among your royalty, but
Navy has a guy named Wave Rider.
My favorite one is a second generation.
Oh yeah, I know which one this is.
Who is at the University of Buffalo? His father played at Nebraska.
Mm-hmm.
Wonderful, terrific Mons the Second.
Yes. You don't let that name fall by the wayside.
Absolutely not. I hope I live long enough to meet wonderful, terrific Mons the Fourth.
Under new rules instituted by the NCAA this week, Charlie, schools that don't graduate enough players will not be eligible for postseason play. I know you're not a huge fan of that venerable institution, but is this a move that makes sense?
Yes, this is the Academic Fraud Protection Act of 2011. You'll be amazed at the graduation rates over the next few years.
I'm sure. UConn, the winners of the men's basketball championship last year, by the way, would not have been eligible to play under the new rules.
Oh,
so
they'd have found a way.
I'm curious about whether there are job openings for academic tutors in Stuart's, Connecticut this week.
I don't know, but if I had a bunch of Sociology 101 term papers, I could make a lot of money next year.
European basketball teams are still doing their best to attract NBA talent in the wake of that league's lockout. What do you think of the pitch currently being made by England's Cheshire Jets to one Ron Artest?
They're going to turn him into an international man of mystery, baby. They're going to help him with his music and movie career.
Excellent.
I don't know that Cheshire is noted for its being a hub of the UK music and movie industry, but apparently they have ambitions.
There were two significant occurrences during the first round of the PGA Championship in Atlanta. Steve Stricker shot a major record-tying 63 on day one, and Tiger Woods shot his worst round ever at the PGA Championships, a 77. Which is more significant?
Well, I think ultimately it will be Tiger Woods because it's further indication that he has a long way to go before becoming even a competitive championship-level professional golfer anymore. Steve Stricker shoots a 63. He could shoot an 83 on Saturday. It's the way these things go. It is interesting, though, that 63 has turned into the four-minute mile. You get to sit there with a chance of 62, and nobody ever does it. He missed an easy 10-foot putt that would have become the first player to shoot 62 in a major. In the majors, that is now the barrier. It's like the sound barrier.
Mr. NASCAR,
uh-oh.
I hate to bring to your attention a situation that might embarrass your sport, but what the heck has been going on with the pit crew for Juan Pablo Montoya's Sprint Cup team?
Well, they've let their entrepreneurial freak flag fly, Bill, and they've been smuggling dope all over the country. The front tire changer was one of two members of Earnhardt Ganassi Racing who were arrested for trafficking 10.5 pounds of marijuana that they apparently mailed from California through a national carrier. Never a good idea. By the way, they both likely face suspension under NASCAR's drug policy. You can't get anything by NASCAR, no. I'm telling you.
I'm told that there is a huge interest in beach volleyball, and I don't doubt it. And I'm also told that there's a considerable interest in the backside of the bikini bottoms of the beach volleyball players. Yes, how do those two interests intersect exactly?
The interest in the backside of beach volleyball players, Bill, is sort of an ongoing concern. But now someone's found a way to commercialize it, which is they put a quick response or a barcode on the bikini bottoms of the players, and then you can photograph it on a smartphone and take the user to a specific website, which will be printed on the back of the bikini bottoms to ensure it catches the eye of spectators.
I think this means it's my turn to say...
Sports!
And finally, Charlie, a fellow in Argentina named Walter Rotundo recently became the father of twin daughters, so congratulations and good on him. And I sure hope his wife is a soccer fan because his daughters' names are...
Mata and Donna, both of which are beautiful names. He said he did it because he, quote, owed two goals to the English, unquote. And I hope they follow their namesake in name only.
Charlie Pierce.
Otherwise, they may wind up working for Earnhardt Ganassi Racing.
Charlie Pierce is the author of Idiot America, among other books, and he joins me each week at this time on Only a Game. Thank you, Charlie.
Thanks, Bill.
Solamente la mano de Dios podrá separarnos. Cuando tú me trajiste tu amor, ya te estaba esperando.
As a child, Jerry Yang liked playing marbles. Since he and his fellow Laotians living in a refugee camp in Thailand during the 70s had no money to buy marbles, they made their own out of stones. As an adult, Jerry Yang discovered that he enjoyed playing poker. And just a few years after he made that discovery, he earned a seat at the final table at the World Series of Poker in Las Vegas, where millions of dollars can change hands on the turn of a card. In his book, All In, written with Mark Tabb, Jerry Yang describes his journey from Laos, which he fled with his family, to the top of the poker heap. Jerry Yang joins me now from KFCF in Fresno, California. Welcome to Only a Game.
Well, thank you so much for having me. I want to thank your show and also KFCF for having me in their studio.
Tell us a little bit about the circumstances under which you and your family left your home in Laos when you were, I guess, 7 years old?
I was 7 at the time, yes. The village that I lived in, we lived very close to the border of Vietnam, and I grew up in the war zone, and aside from that, I was always hungry, and my father fought along with the American soldiers during the Vietnam War. He was assigned to the Ho Chi Minh, the infamous Trail Ho Chi Minh, and not only my father, but many other villagers in my village, and thousands of Hmong people. And I just want to correct you earlier. My nationality is actually Hmong, but we live in Laos. Mm-hmm. So they invaded my country in May of 1975. And my family had no choice but to escape to our neighboring country, Thailand.
Your father's service was also, I gather, the reason that your family did eventually, after 4 years in the refugee camp in Thailand, make it to the United States.
That's correct, yes. We were given options to go to France, Canada, and to some other South American countries, but my father refused. So he said, you know, I fought along with those American soldiers. I put my life on the line. I want to go to America because I truly believe that only in America that I would be able to experience freedom and peace.
Now, interestingly enough, you write that for the first 30-plus years of your life, you never played a hand of cards. Why not?
I grew up, my father, to be honest with you, my father is a true disciplinarian. And I remember growing up, I was the most mischievous child in my family. And my father never allowed us to play chess or checkers because he thought that those games would lead us into gambling. And so we never had that opportunity at all.
What changed your mind about cards, or more specifically about poker?
I used to be a clinical psychologist, and having interviewed a lot of my clients throughout my career, I mean, I could tell when a client is lying to me or they're telling me the truth. And just based on their body gestures and the way they cross their legs and whether or not they purse their lips when they speak to me. So I use some of those at the poker table. And when I first discovered poker in 2005, it was November, and I remember sitting next to my wife on the sofa, and I saw poker for the very first time, and I knew that I could do it.
So this was when you were sitting on the sofa with your wife. You were watching poker on TV.
That's correct.
This may be the greatest advertisement possible for televised poker, that they drew in a guy who eventually went on to be one of the most successful players in the world.
Yeah, and my wife had, if she had grabbed the remote control that night, I mean, we would be watching HGTV, you know. But I mean, not to say anything bad about HGTV, I love that show, but that night would just happen to be my night. I just happened to grab the remote control first, and I switched it to channel 144 ESPN, and there it was, you know, the final table of the World Series of Poker.
Your wife was not enthusiastic about your new hobby when you told her that you thought this would be something you should get into. How did you convince her that you wouldn't be risking the family's security when you started playing poker?
Oh, goodness, Bill, that's the best part. I remember when I saw poker on TV, I pointed to the TV and I turned to her and I said, honey, I can do that. And when I win, I will use the money for good. And I remember she turned to me and she gave me this very, very disgusting look. And yeah, and Bill, you know, when you have six kids like me and a mortgage and a car payment, I don't blame her a bit. But I made a promise to her that I would take only 5% of my paycheck to play. And that's what I did. And I, to her surprise and to my surprise, I started winning. And now she's my biggest fan.
How soon after you began playing in tournaments with $25 entry fees did you know that you could compete one day with the heavyweights?
Oh, that was my ultimate dream, Bill. I wanted to go to the World Series of Poker, especially playing in the main event. So in May of 2007, I invested $225, and I competed against 187 other players at an Indian casino where I lived. And I beat every single of them that day. And I remember they brought out the $10,000 and they said, Jerry, you have a couple of choices. You either take the $10,000, forget about World Series and go home and enjoy your $10,000, or let us use the $10,000 to buy the seat in Vegas. And when July comes, you will go there and play in the main event. And Bill, that was a very, very tough decision. I walked around in the casino for like a couple of hours. I didn't want to call my wife because I knew if I called her, she would say, take the money and come home. And so I didn't call her. I told them to go ahead and register me in for the seat, and they did that. And in July, I went to Vegas, and I played, and I 9 days later, I won the whole thing.
You are known for, among other things, for praying at the poker table, and you write that one of your prayers is, and I'm quoting now, Lord, let me survive this hand. Have you ever prayed for a specific card to show up?
Absolutely not. Absolutely not. I don't think it's fair for me to pray to God to give me a specific card, because I believe that God loves me just the same like he loves my opponent, and it wouldn't be fair for me to do that. But I truly believe that by praying, that gives me the strength and the wisdom and the courage to really play to the best of my ability.
Before you won millions of dollars at poker, you worked with at-risk children in Southern California as a psychologist. I'm wondering if you still do that sort of work, or has winning the World Series of Poker changed everything?
I don't do that anymore, Bill. The day that I won, my boss was very kind, and he called me and he said, Jerry, don't even bother coming back. He was very kind, yeah. And I said, well, I still want to give my 2 weeks' notice like everybody else. And he said, no, don't worry about it. Just go. And so he was very gracious to do that. And when after I won, I saw a window of opportunity. I made a promise in front of ESPN cameras and also before God that I would donate 10% to three different charitable organizations, the Ronald McDonald House, which I am a big fan, and also the Make-A-Wish Foundation and Feed the Children, for one very specific reason. I used to be there. I used to be poor. I used to be hungry. I used to be sick. I used to be hopeless, just like those children, and I wanted to do that. So after the win, I donated the 10%, and I wanted to do more. And I, you know, so as I travel, I hosted charity events benefiting the Make-A-Wish and or the Ronald McDonald House, and I have personally raised over $800,000 since my win, and I will continue to do more. So I will continue to play, you know, to the best of my ability, and as long as my schedule permits me to do so. I love the game of poker, and I will continue to do it.
Jerry Yang with Mark Tabb wrote All In, From Refugee Camp to Poker Champ, published by Medallion, and he joined me from KFCF in Fresno, California. Jerry, thank you very much for speaking with me.
Thank you, Bill. You have a wonderful day.
Only a Game is produced by Karen Given and Doug Trabu. Our technical director is John Ferrati. Our intern this summer has been Allison Gluck, to whom we bid a very fond adieu. We had help this week from Rich Withers at KFCF in Fresno. Special thanks this week to Paul Vitkus. Our senior producer is Gary Wallach. To view our photo galleries or learn more about this week's music selections, please visit our website, onlyagame.org. Our final word comes from the Miami Herald's Michelle Kaufman, who summarizes the Magic Jack soccer team thusly.
There are teams that are better run and there are teams that are worse run, but I've never seen a team that doesn't have a phone number.
Well, how can you expect the team to know how to get one? After all, it's not like they're owned by a phone service provider. Bill Littlefield, thank you for listening. Over and out.
Support comes from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information at macfound.org. The William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people, online at wtgrantfoundation.org. And the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live healthy, productive lives, at gatesfoundation.org. This is NPR.